This is the 21st Show. I'm Brian Mackey, and we're going to talk now about the second of two new national parks in Illinois. Pullman National Historical Park is on the south side of Chicago. The Pullman area was first built in the 1880s, the first planned industrial community in the country. For many years, it's where the famous Pullman sleeper railroad cars were made, and the Pullman strike that broke out there in 1894 marked a key moment in the history of the American labor movement. Another essential element of the Pullman story are the experiences of the area's black communities, especially the thousands of men hired over the years as Pullman porters, and their role in organizing and the civil rights movement. The area was designated as a national monument in 2015, and late last year, President Biden signed legislation redesignating it as a national park. We spoke about this briefly last month with U.S. Representative Robin Kelly, whose Chicago office is just blocks away from the park, and who sponsored the legislation that made this happen. Here's what she had to say about what Pullman means to her.
We have been pushing this. I've been in Congress for 10 years. In April, I've been pushing it since then. Just the history, and it's, yes, Black history, but it's American history, talking about labor unions, the Pullman porters, A. Philip Randolph. I just think it's so important for people to know about the railroads and the significance, you know, in United States history. So it's very meaningful, and just in the area is very meaningful because it's helped with economic development and, you know, what could be deemed a tough, maybe not immediately there, but all surrounding, you know, that area. So I'm thrilled.
Joining us now to talk about the area and its legacy is Lynn McClure, Midwest Senior Regional Director with the National Parks Conservation Association. Lynn, thank you for joining us today on the 21st Show.
Well, thank you, Brian. And I am going to, because I only just joined the audio, I am going to ask you whose voice I just heard. It sounded very familiar.
Oh, sure. That was Congresswoman Robin Kelly, who sponsored the legislation for this. And yeah, we had some issues connecting. So Lynn McClure, we're also joined now by Sue Bennett, who is the Assistant Superintendent of Pullman National Historical Park. Thank you both for being here. And listeners, as ever, we welcome your thoughts and questions now as ever. Especially if you've ever visited Pullman yourself, what did you think of it? What do you want to know about the history of the Pullman community? You can join our conversation today by giving us a call at 800-222-9455. That's 800-222-9455. Or send us an email. The address is talk@21stshow.org. Again, talk@21stshow.org. And so, Lynn, I'm going to begin with you. Can you just explain for our listeners the significance of Pullman being designated a national park?
I sure can. I am not a historian. I leave that to those who are well steeped in that, such as Sue from the National Park Service. But there are only 400, there were only 405 of these places when we all started talking about Pullman becoming a national park site, and now there are 426. So first of all, we're a pretty big country, and Pullman is one of a very elite group of places that are there because they tell an incredibly important American story. And in Pullman's case, there are four unique stories going on in Pullman that just don't happen at any other site in this country. But there, I would also say from a non-historic standpoint, it's a huge significance for the city of Chicago to get its first national park. And that's what Pullman really represents. And I thought I recognized your voice, Congresswoman. It's really nice to be with you again here on this kind of platform. But boy, it's hard to underestimate the passion and the ardor that was pursued to get Pullman designated from Robin Kelly to so many others.
And I should say that was just tape from Congresswoman Kelly. We spoke with her a few weeks ago. I know you were joining late, so that was not she's not here with us live. But Sue Bennett, Assistant Superintendent of Pullman National Historical Park. I want to bring you into the conversation first. Just a sort of semantic question: what is the difference between a national historic park, as New Philadelphia is, which we talked about on the program a week or two ago, and a national historical park, which is what Pullman is?
So the semantics for that, and good morning, Brian, is simply how Congress and the legislation described it. There is a national park system, and we were originally designated a national monument in 2015 by President Barack Obama. He used an Antiquities Act, a 1906 authority, where the president can designate a national monument. But only Congress has the authority to designate national parks. And so it took legislation then to change our name from a national monument to a national historical park. But the difference between a historic park like New Philadelphia and a historical park like Pullman is really just how our elected officials chose to name us. We are all part of the same umbrella, the same family, just special places in America that either have these impressive, important ecosystems, or in the case of New Philadelphia and Pullman, a great nexus of American history and significant things that have happened with the people in a particular place.
Absolutely. Well, Sue, let's paint a picture for our listeners here. Obviously, we're on the radio, but if someone were right now to go to the Pullman National Historical Park, what would they see during their visit?
The thing that would track them in is the thing that tracked visitors here in the 1880s. George Pullman built a massive railroad rail car manufacturing town and integrated it with his housing, and built a showpiece, which was the administration building, which is a three-story building with a clock tower on it. People riding on the Illinois Central Rail tracks in the 1880s would go past it and see this beautiful campus and this nice plantings, a nice reflecting pond, and this looming clock that was overseeing the whole campus. And that is indeed the focal point when you start to approach it from afar. We are embedded with our state historic site. They are taking care of some of the remaining red brick manufacturing buildings on site. And really, it's a wonderful multi-block residential community of 1880s red brick row houses with some nice park and landscaping and amenities placed throughout it. And if you close your eyes and get dropped into the landscape and then open them again, it is pretty easy to imagine how Illinois and this transportation hub in Chicago might have looked in the 1880s. You can still see a variety of different kinds of row houses, the beautiful historic hotel, the Greenstone Church, the historic fire station, some of the historic manufacturing buildings from the exterior, and of course the clock tower, which houses the new National Park Service Visitor Center. So it's really an outdoor campus with an opportunity to go into some of the indoor spaces.
Let me take a moment to remind listeners, if you're just joining us, this is the 21st show, and we are talking about one of Illinois' two newest national parks. This is the Pullman National Historical Park on the south side of Chicago, of course, home to the great rail manufacturing community, but also important in the stories of American Black history and labor history. Here we're talking about this. You just heard there the voice of Sue Bennett, who is Assistant Superintendent of the park, and Lynn McClure, Midwest Senior Regional Director with the National Parks Conservation Association. 800-222-9455 if you want to join our conversation. We have a couple calls coming in. We're going to ask you to just hold on a few minutes. Lynn, I do want to ask you, because Sue there mentioned the sort of the community, and I understand a lot of the land is still privately owned. Can you talk, Lynn, about the efforts of working with the community? I guess even maybe going back to the 1960s, when there was a plan to demolish a lot of this and build a new industrial park, but in, you know, working with the community to make this instead a national historical park.
Yeah, thanks, Brian. You know, what NPCA kind of brought here at Pullman was the ability to connect the desire and passion of the people who live there, the members of Congress who love national parks, together with a path to the road for success. So one of the things that was critical in the path to get the park designated itself was the devotion and passion of the community members, the neighborhood people who really wanted a park there. We kind of thoughtfully took some of their questions, like, will there be a lot of new law enforcement? Will we have, my favorite one, will we have park rangers on horseback? All the way to things like, will I still be able to park in front of my house when I get home from work? And try to sort out the realities of living in a national park. Because when you think of most national parks, the Grand Canyon or Yellowstone, it isn't that way. You walk in and you walk into this great big space that is sort of consistently a national park. But Pullman is a lived-in neighborhood. And it was that very factor, the people who lived there back in the 1960s and earlier, whose families lived there, that still live there today, that brought the success of making a national park, and that even came in and preserved all those unique historic buildings that Sue mentioned and all the row houses from demolition back in the 60s. I love it when you call something positive, like this is urban renewal, when in fact this is really tearing down history, which is what went on across the country to a degree.
And it's that an Orwellian was naming convention, isn't it? Yes.
Yeah, it is, right? But that's really what Pullman was at risk of becoming. And what a tremendous loss that could have been. But this was a neighborhood of fighters, and they are still a neighborhood of fighters who saved it and who continue to make Pullman set up for success for the future.
All right, I want to go down to the phone. Steve is calling from Chicago on line 4. Steve, thank you for calling in. I understand you've been to Pullman.
Yeah, Brian, thanks a lot. Enjoying the program quite a bit. I actually grew up on the South Side, and I've been to the Hotel Florence several times. I'm going back 25, 30 years, but they used to have a really spectacular Sunday brunch there, and it was just, and you could, you know, walk through the hotel at that time. What took me aback was somebody had posted the menu from the hotel, oh God, going back to the early 1900s, and the food was elaborate and the prices were, as you can imagine, pretty ridiculous. I know the neighborhood has fallen on hard times, and I think the hotel itself, I think there might have been a fire, so I don't know if that has been restored or how it affected the hotel. But I watched a bio on Pullman, and the funny thing about it is it used to be almost a half a day for him to ride by carriage from the hotel to his Prairie Street mansion. And, of course, now it's all expressways. But one interesting aside is if you've ever seen the movie The Fugitive with Harrison Ford, 1992, part of it was actually shot in the Pullman neighborhood. So those are my recollections, and those are my memories, and it's a great site, and I'd encourage anybody to stop by for a visit. Thanks a lot.
Right. Thanks so much for calling in, Steve. We appreciate it. Sue, let me ask you about, Steve there mentioned George Pullman. Talk a little bit about his sort of drive. How did he settle on the idea of building not just a factory, but an entire community?
Well, George Pullman is one of those American icons that you love to hate. He was an underdog early on in his life, a self-made man, hardworking man, happened to be at the right time at the right place in New York as they were building canals, learned how to move buildings, came to Chicago and moved a lot of our buildings up out of the swamp as we were building our roads, took that investment, went west to Colorado. Didn't do the mining, but astutely ran businesses that supplied the miners, all the while thinking about, I think I have an idea to make transportation more pleasant, more comfortable. And so started fiddling with rail cars and modifying them to create a much more comfortable sleeping accommodation, making it plush, and originally started building his rail cars in Detroit. But they were a little stuck in the middle of town there, and the only expansion they could do in Detroit was go up. And so he had a vision of, I want to consolidate my campus. I want to bring everything together, bring in my co-located vendors. You know, it sounds like a modern, smart business practice, but Mr. Pullman was thinking about that in the 1880s. Found some property outside of the city of Chicago, outside of city regulations, also a good, astute business practice. Built a sprawling campus that could be changed and adjusted as technology changed and adjusted. And then did something that his capitalist peers weren't doing. He built a town to house his workers. He felt that good, clean living would enforce good, clean morals in a workforce, give them an opportunity to have some loyalty to the organization. And it went swimmingly well for about 20 years until 1894. We were in the middle of an economic recession in America, and the rail car manufacturing slowed down. They laid off some workers. They took some product at loss. But the town and the company that ran the town did not reduce the rent. And as workers asked for relief from Mr. Pullman and the company, they didn't think that was necessary. They were intransigent. They said no. And the Pullman workers walked off the job. And the time was ripe for this little old local Pullman strike to catch flame nationally, where people were upset about the workforce in America and around the country. And remember, this is when commerce was done by railroads. Around the country, trains stopped moving if they had a Pullman car attached to it. And so in the summer of 1894, commerce kind of came to a halt for about 3 months. Federal troops came in.
Sorry to interrupt you, but I think you said commerce came to a halt in that summer, and actually we need to come to a halt for a break on our program. So that's a good sort of cliffhanger, and we will talk more about the outcome of the 1894 Pullman strike and its importance, and one of the reasons that Pullman is a National Historical Park today. We're talking about this with Sue Bennett, who's the Assistant Superintendent of Pullman National Historical Park, and Lynn McClure from the National Parks Conservation Association. 800-222-9455 if you want to join our conversation today. More to come after a short break. This is the 21st Show. Stay with us. This is the 21st Show. I'm Brian Mackey. We are talking about one of Illinois' newest national parks, and that is the Pullman National Historical Site on the south side of Chicago. We're talking about this with Lynn McClure, Midwest Senior Regional Director with the National Parks Conservation Association, and Sue Bennett, Assistant Superintendent of Pullman National Historical Park. 800-222-9455 if you want to join our conversation today. That's 800-222-9455. We're going to be talking about Pullman porters. Maybe you might have even known someone who worked as a Pullman porter, or maybe is the descendant of a Pullman porter. Let us know about it at 800-222-9455. Before we do talk about the porters, though, Sue, I want to give you an opportunity to finish the story about the strike and the sort of lasting effect that had on American labor.
And who'd have thought an 1894 strike could be a cliffhanger today? That's awesome. So commerce not going, it was a bad deal. And so federal troops came in and forced people to start moving train cars again. And pretty much everybody lost. The workers lost. The train makers lost. George Pullman lost. And in fact, the strike and this national boycott was pinned on him for his unwillingness to negotiate. And, you know, he got a bad reputation despite the good work he'd done beforehand. And so there are people that love and hate Mr. Pullman, but he is a classic American self-made man, a capitalist who had a vision and a dream and did it and hired a lot of folks. But there were some issues with some labor unrest. Transitioning, there was a group sitting on the sidelines during the 1894 strike, and that was the Pullman porters. The onboard service staff that provided that exceptional service on those rail cars during that strike when trains weren't moving, they were laid off too. They were prohibited from joining the union. African-Americans were not allowed to be in the American Railway Workers Union. that was a big proponent of the national boycott. And it took them until 1937 to finally get a good contract and break that barrier, that race barrier line, as an African-American organization. And it happened to be with the Pullman Company. And so they broke down that ceiling and that door and created a path for Pullman porters and African-American workers to get better wages, training, safety, employment opportunity, just like their fellow white workers.
Well, let's talk more about those Pullman porters, because, as you mentioned, they worked on board the sleeping cars. We have some audio we'd like to play. This is a 1988 interview with someone named Jesse Mitchell, who worked as a Pullman porter starting in the 1930s. Let's listen to that.
I was working 250 hours a month. The porter's job was to take care of the passengers, keep the car tidied up, take care of your guests at night. We would sit all night. We had a stool at the end of the car, a chair at the end of the car. I was sitting in that chair all night. When I looked down the hall, if somebody wanted to get up, you have to be available to get them out of the upper berth. I would stay up 20 hours a day, 4 hours rest at night, get up, go the next day, same thing, 20 hours. So it took a lot of wear and tear out of you.
Yeah, 250 hours a month. That's more than double the 40-hour work week. So, Sue, say more. Who were the Pullman porters and what conditions they worked and lived in?
That was wonderful to hear Mr. Jesse Mitchell's words. The jobs were had some dualities to it. You know, coming out of the Civil War, recently emancipated Southern formerly enslaved house workers were hired by the Pullman Company early in the 1870s, 1880s, 1890s. And then during the Great Migration, 1900 to 1920, many folks from the South, African-American workers, came north, came to work for the railroad, came to work for the Pullman Company in particular, because they got jobs for wages. But the wages weren't enough, and they were supplemented by tips, and they had to hustle for tips. The company had exacting standards. There were racial barriers on the car. The porters did suffer abuse by some of the customers, some of the clients that they were serving. But they were able to have a source of pride. They were well revered and respected in the communities. They lived all over the country at rail hubs, downtown Chicago, Detroit, Denver, Sacramento, New York, you know, the St. Louis. They worked long hours and had some opportunities, bought homes, were able to raise their families, you know, sort of move forward into the middle class, so they say. Many of the efforts that it took for these Pullman porters to organize to win their union contract as the Brotherhood of Sleeping Car Porters in 1937 was actually the same group of men, an organization that helped move the country towards the civil rights of the 1960s. A. Philip Randolph, Mr. Webster from Chicago, many folks have a porter story that we get to hear about when they come to Pullman.
Well, that is a great segue to another clip that we have lined up. So we talked about the 1894 Pullman strike and how the porters were sort of on the sidelines of that, even though they had been laid off. They organized, they formed the Brotherhood of Sleeping Car Porters. It takes 12 years for their efforts to bear fruit. And this is going forward decades as we're talking since that strike. And this clip we have is from another 1988 interview with C.L. Dellums, who was at the time the sole surviving member of the group that organized the union. Let's hear that.
We were 10 years gaining recognition, 10 long, bitter years. We don't know how many men lost their jobs because of their union activities or their membership. In some places, if they saw them going in and out of the Brotherhood offices, they would be fired. You know, there were some very dark days.
And we have one more piece of tape we want to play. So you mentioned A. Philip Randolph and his role in organizing this. This is a tape about Randolph from the first voice we heard, the porter Jesse Mitchell. Let's listen to this.
It was a wonderful thing that he did for the civil rights of this country. Mr. A. Philip Randolph, he brought us from a long ways. If it hadn't been for him and Mr. Martin Luther King, I don't think that this country would be out of struggle as yet.
So, Sue, can you say more about that connection between the Union, the Pullman Porters, and the civil rights movement in the decades to come?
At the time that the Union was trying to form, the Pullman Company actually was the largest single employer of African Americans in the United States. So their success, the Brotherhood of Sleeping Car Porters and their contract, really kicked down that door for other employers to follow suit. And Mr. Randolph, who was not an employee of the company, was a fantastic speaker, fantastic orator. He was well known, and he spoke power to his words and really led the porters. I would be remiss if I didn't mention their wives. You know, you heard Mr. Mitchell talk about, and Mr. Dullums talk about, you know, people lost jobs. So the men could not be seen communicating, but their wives, the women's auxiliary, could communicate in church and in social settings. And so it was really a united effort with the families and community to create this force to be reckoned with. And they used an organization with A. Philip Randolph that they were going to march on Washington, but they didn't need to. There was a change in regulation, and so the plan was set aside, but then dusted off and resurrected for the 1960s March on Washington. In fact, A. Philip Randolph was there kicking off the day and the event, and was one of the men that said that we should pick this young man, this Dr. King, to be our fiery speaker for the day. And so really, you know, the sacrifice, the persistence, the resistance of this African-American workforce fighting to get the same rights as their white brothers and sisters doing similar kinds of jobs was an inspiration and a lesson that is still important today. And that's part of why, you know, this Pullman site is so important. I would also be remiss if I didn't mention, we're not the only storytellers here in Pullman. We're the National Park Service, but we work closely with the state of Illinois for Pullman State Historic Sites. There's the Historic Pullman Foundation, the Pullman at Home Project, and of course, the National A. Philip Randolph Pullman Porter, all here within the National Historical Park boundaries. And so we're fortunate to have some folks that can do deep dives in experiences and stories. And so there's so much to learn. It's a complex story, but there's something in that story that still sparks an interest and a resonance with today's headline.
Absolutely. Lynn McClure, I want to bring you back into the conversation now from the National Parks Conservation Association. Talk about what the improvements to the area in recent years, what has been done there? What's that meant for the communities around Pullman?
Sure. Thank you, Brian. And, you know, this goes to what Steve, when he called in, talked about a neighborhood that had fallen on hard times. And I think that was probably true 10 years ago or so. But in the 8 short years since Pullman was established, we've seen well over $100 million invested in that community and in adjacent neighborhoods. The investments have been in public transit, increased service, new stations, viaduct improvements, sidewalks, streets, bike paths, and probably the single most amazing is that the factory and clock tower that Sue mentioned in the beginning of the program had a big old fence around it with barbed wire on the top, and that fence has come down. And there is a complete renovation of the 12 acres, the $36 million project that has opened a new visitor center at Pullman. So it is not the same place it was back in the day, right? Or maybe it is. Maybe it is becoming the same place it used to be, really vibrant with all those historic buildings open to the public and really able to experience. When Sue talked about the strike, the workers' gait that was in every photo that you saw of the Pullman strike in 1894. That gait has been reconstructed on site so that people today can walk from the Pullman neighborhood through the same gates that the workers took and that the strike started. So it's really a profound change in that neighborhood, kind of leveraged by the national park and the commitment of the state, the city of Chicago, and private philanthropy to make it all happen. And it'll keep going. This is just tip of the iceberg. Next up is doing a series of bike paths that will connect Pullman to some natural areas across the expressway and other bike paths and road improvements that will help make connection to nearby neighborhoods. So it's tremendous.
Lynn McClure is the Midwest Senior Regional Director with the National Parks Conservation Association. We've also been speaking with Sue Bennett, Assistant Superintendent at the Pullman National Historical Park. Sue and Lynn, thank you so much for being with us today on the 21st show. We really appreciate your time.
Well, thank you. I mean, there is no day greater than when we get to talk about Pullman, right, Sue?
Indeed, Lynn. Thank you, Brian.
Tomorrow on the 21st show, there is growing interest in the idea of a four-day work week, kind of like our four-day show week. Some experts say it could reduce stress while actually increasing productivity. We want to know, would you be interested in working 4 days a week? How might that change your life? Or do you think we should stick to the tried and true Monday through Friday routine? You can let us know what you think by emailing us. talk@21stshow.org is the address, or better yet, leave us a voicemail. The number for that is 217-300-2121. That's 217-300-2121. You can call that number anytime, day or night. You can find that number and our email address, every other way to contact us, on our website, 21stshow.org. While you're there, you can also find links to our podcast or just search for The 21st Show on Apple or Spotify or wherever you get your podcasts. The 21st Show is produced by Christine Hatfield and Jose Zepeda. Our interns are Owen Henderson and Anaya Jones. Technical direction and engineering comes from Jason Croft and Steve Mork. And Reginald Hardwick is our news director. The 21st Show is a production of Illinois Public Media. I'm Brian Mackey. Thanks for listening. We'll talk with you again tomorrow.